All right, Mr. Huffman.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you to turn to the larger of the two books now, Barris for Investment Performance Review. I tried to keep the economics review brief to the point. If we turn to tab one and skip ahead to page six, we'll take a quick look at the U.S. economic summary. So on this page on the right-hand side, we have GDP showing here, annualized rate of 2%. First estimate of first quarter came in at 0.7%. We get a second estimate of that number tomorrow morning, so we'll see what that looks like, but not expecting significantly different. So first quarter looks like it's a little bit slower than what we have been seeing, but that's not surprising. We've seen first quarter be a little bit slower in the past several years, and then we tend to see a catch-up of that activity in the second quarter. So this looks like it's playing out as normal, but we're not to the 3 or 4% growth that the Trump administration promised us when they were trying to get elected. So we still have to let that play out a little bit further. We'll see. The inflation number coming in at 2.8%, that's bopped around a little bit. March, it was a negative 0.3%, and then April back up positive 0.2%. So inflation has ticked up a little bit, but doesn't look like it's running out of control in any means. This is comforting to our Fed, who's looking at their mandate of trying to maintain inflation at a 2% level, plus or minus, and it looks like that's right where we're at. So that gives them room to continue raising rates when they see fit. And the expectation right now by the market is that a rate raise will come in June. This is kind of interesting because we've gone through a couple rate increases now, and we haven't seen the sell-off in the equity markets. Right. And in the past, any time they talked about it, the equity markets, first thing they did was sell off. Now the equity market is saying, yeah, we're ready for it. It makes sense. So we're seeing some acceptance there.
Ed, aren't they also talking about, they being the Treasury here, issuing 50-year and maybe 100-year bonds? You know, it just is mind-boggling to me.
And I think the initial response was, don't do it, there's no demand. And then the Treasury responded, but we think we're going to do it anyhow. So it would be interesting to see. I think, yeah, they probably want to be able to lock in some of these low rates for a long time. It also helps fund a lot of the administration.
It doesn't surprise me on the selling side. What surprises me is the buyers.
Oh,
To bet that we'll have no substantive inflation, which is what these rates say for that period of time, is just mind-boggling to me.
Yeah, and it also extends beyond what we think of as kind of the typical 30-year buyer. Like if you're a corporate plan and you want to, you know, liability match a portion of your plan or something like that, the 30-year treasury is a good way, or it's a tool for helping to do that. When you get out to 50 or 100, I'm not sure why you do that. I agree. We'll see. I don't know.
The good news is nobody's ever going to be able to sit there and say you were wrong.
Well, it's also interesting because we don't know what rate that would come in on. So they do these via auction. So if they do an auction and the pricing isn't there, then you're going to see a higher yield because it'll be a lower price for that bond. So it might be the market's way of telling them that, no, we do see inflation and we see other risks ahead, and we're not going to buy this for a 3% yield or something like that. Down below a little bit, we're going to get into the labor market. So here we're showing the unemployment U3 here at 4.5. The April number ticked down a little bit to 4.4, and U6 below that at 8.9. So that's an interesting segue then into page 8 as we take this deeper look at the labor market. On the left-hand side, we're seeing unemployment improve. And so it continues to improve, which is nice. It's not happening as fast as anyone would like. But the lower left-hand side shows that by these two measures, the U3 and the broader U6, unemployment is coming down. Job openings in the middle chart have increased, and so there are job openings, and so it's really a shifting there of the labor market to fill those openings, and how long does it take to get retrained and reskilled to be able to fill those. But as a result, the right-hand side is real average hourly earnings haven't been doing much. And when we say real, we mean that this is adjusted for inflation. So if you saw the nominal number, This would be more like a 2% increase in earnings. That's nice, 2%, but it really is only keeping up with inflation. And that's what this is showing here, is that we're basically at 0%. So that's important to us, because with the consumer being 70% of our GDP, if they're not seeing more earnings, it's hard to expect them to spend any more unless they take on debt. So maybe they do take on debt, in which case, let's turn to page 10. And here we take a look at consumer spending on the left-hand side. And you can see that left-hand side chart is basically right around a 2% number there, where it has been for some time. In fact, kind of 15 years sometime. So it's been right around 2%. So that's kind of marching in line with where it has been. Household net worth in the middle is a nice story. So this increase is partially due to the equity markets. Equity markets have been doing well, and we as consumers and investors have benefited from that. But there's also a large part of this that's due to people just saving more. They're putting it in their cash, in their bank accounts. So that's good news there. And then let's make sure they're not taking out debt. And the right-hand side shows that. The right-hand side is consumer credit. This does not include mortgages. This is credit cards, auto loans, student loans, things like that. And here we're seeing that consumer credit growth is flat, roughly 5%. So that seems to be a good thing as well. Yes, sir.
From my long ago days of studying economics, I seem to recall the savings paradox was in part that with the growth in savings, it tended to put a downward push on the market, because rather than actively investing money, people were saving money. So the fact that you're getting both here is kind of, do you see that as unusual, or is it, am I dating myself when I say this?
No, I think theoretically that's right. And then when you look at the reality and you say that there are all of these countervailing winds to deal with, how does it play out in today's environment, and how has it played out over history? And so for a while there, coming out of 2008, the demand for money was very, very high. Everyone wanted cash and was willing to part ways with their house, their boat, their everything else, their stocks, their bonds, to hold cash. Money, cash was dear. And it still has a bit of that. There's still a risk aversion component there. And what I earn, I want to just put in cash. This is what the consumer is saying, not me. That I want to maintain that cash. They are also investing in the stock market. And so part of what we're seeing is that there's an increase in cash balances. We're not seeing lending, so that part has gotten more conservative, and they're investing. So it's actually just more prudent overall. So it is a combination of, if anything, we're seeing that the debt side of it is getting some relief. People are deleveraging.
You might also say that perhaps the market is overvalued.
We'll get to that in a moment, too.
Okay.
Yep.
All right.
We'll come back to the equity markets towards the end, but it might be. Let's jump ahead to page 23, take a look at the international landscape. Lots going on internationally now that we have the French election in the rearview mirror. We have a few other things we can talk about. So top line just gives United States for reference. Then Western Europe showing 1.8% GDP growth and modest inflation, which is nice to see. So they're coming out of it, and we're seeing that the equity markets internationally are doing okay, and Western Europe is doing okay. Unemployment 8.6, but that's really a regional story. Unemployment in Germany is very low. Unemployment in France and Spain and what have you is much higher in Italy. Japan is showing here at...
What page are you on?
I'm sorry, 16. Oh, I say 23?
23.
I was looking at 23.
This shows we are listening to you.
We're really...
It's a test. We'll be going to 23 next. So, okay, United States, Western Europe, Japan, showing 1.6% GDP growth. The first estimate on 1Q for Japan is 2.2%, so even better. So we're seeing economic growth there. Modest inflation, practically flat, and in fact, they're fighting deflation in a big way, and really tight labor markets there. And then we get into the Brazil, Russia, India, China story, kind of a proxy for emerging markets. And Brazil, we're showing down 2.5% in GDP. They're going through another series of potentially impeaching their president. So he's been there a year. So now getting some headlines for some improprieties there. So we'll see how that plays out. But that continues to evolve. Russia, and then India and China being some real growth engines.
Is the negative birth rate in Japan in part responsible for the lower unemployment rate?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
China just got downgraded by Moody's, right? So that's, does that
people for the jobs
anticipate actually a lower GDP than what's here?
In part, yes. The GDP out of China is hard to really wrap our arms around with in terms of a data integrity. And so that GDP tends to be what they want it to be, or so it seems. And a lot of the underlying indicators suggest a lower number.
Okay.
They've been getting away with it for a few quarters now. And so it seems that there's either a reconciliation that needs to happen if these numbers are really disconnected, or we need better information in terms of how they're doing it, but we don't have the transparency to know that. So it is something we have to take with a grain of salt.
Yeah. One of the recent seminars we went to, I thought it was interesting. I asked a guy about whether or not you could believe the figures that came out of China, and he said, you can't believe the provinces, but you can believe the national figures. So you can believe the roll-ups, but forget the base data. I thought that was pretty interesting.
So you can't believe the parts, but you can believe,
you can believe
some
the
of
whole.
The parts.
Okay. Let's turn to page 23. 23, yeah, now we're ready. So I love these things, yield curves. I think they can tell an interesting story. Sometimes it's accurate. In the upper left-hand side, we have the U.S. yield curve over various time frames. The most current is the red line, 3/31/17. And you can see that compared to the other prior time frames, or the more recent prior time frames, that the short end has come up, so that's the Fed stepping in, and the long end hasn't moved that much at all. And so what we're seeing here is a flattening. The yield curve is getting more flat, and we hear bond managers talk about that frequently. And that's interesting because as the long end of the curve is kind of determined by the market, that suggests that our growth here isn't getting much better. So that 3% kind of number on a 30-year bond is still remaining, and the short end staying at this 75 basis points to 1% is the target of the Fed, so it's flattening out. Now this flattening becomes an issue when it really does get flat or when it goes inverted, when we believe that inflation expectations are higher than growth, and that's a good indicator, a strong indicator for a recession. So this shows that we're not there, that we still have a steep yield curve. In fact, if we took out a couple of these others that are throwing off the scaling a bit, you'd see a relatively steep yield curve for us in the U.S., even though it is flattening. So taking that in mind, we take a look at the right-hand side and can compare it to some other developed nations. And here it's a different story. The top line is China. So across the board, China is experiencing higher yields than we are here. And we've looked at this table, this chart before, where we've had a lot more in the negative interest rate side of things. So we still do have the yellow line is Germany, and they are still negative out to 7-8 years or so. We have the light green line, which is France. They're also slightly negative. And let's see, the red Italy touches in the negative side, and the dark blue Japan is negative out to about 9 or 10 years. But this has changed pretty significantly. These have moved out of negative territory and are heading in that direction, which is good to see. So that's part of the recovery that we've been long anticipating. And also on the long end of the curves, you can see that no one is really anticipating a lot of growth. So this is what the bond market is telling us about the more global markets. And I think that's what's interesting about it, is that these are market forces at work talking, playing, placing bets on the future, and this is where they think it's working out right now. And then down below, we have implied changes over the next year. This, again, is what the bond markets are pricing out. So if we took a look at the U.S., for example, which is the dark blue line, yield change, it's the highest on the short end. So at 1 month, the markets are anticipating the U.S. to raise rates the most, followed by, I think that next one, that dark green, is Italy.
Okay.
And then you can see at the bottom is the red, that's the UK. And so the market is anticipating that the UK has to lower rates. Well, no surprise, they're going through Brexit, and so they might have to lower rates to stimulate some economic growth there. If we skip ahead to page 27, take a quick look at the equities around the world. And this page, more than anything, gives us some insight into what currency markets have been doing. And so what we saw last quarter and last year was a dramatic difference between investing internationally as a local investor versus investing internationally as a U.S. investor. And due to that currency impact, as a U.S. investor, we didn't do nearly as well as the local investors. And so we get that by the hedged and unhedged columns. As a hedged investor, that's what it would be like to be the local participant in the market. The unhedged is what it is to convert it back into U.S. dollars. So the trend that we saw last year being that U.S. investors had much lower returns has reversed, essentially. And so the dollar stopped its strengthening relative to most major currencies here in the first quarter. And so we're seeing that the unhedged actually helped. So that's good. We have a good portion of the portfolio allocated to international equities. So this is actually a tailwind that helped us. If we turn to page 33, take a look at equity valuations. So coming back to the question, is the market expensive? And the left-hand side gives us the IFA, the orange bar being the international developed markets, the dark blue being the United States, and the whatever you want to call that tealish kind of color being emerging markets. And you can see here that we have five valuation metrics: price to book value, price to earnings, price to free cash flow, dividend yield, and earnings yield. And by the first three, emerging markets look cheap, even by dividend yield. Earnings yield, slightly higher. So emerging markets has had a nice run, which we'll see momentarily. They still look relatively cheap. U.S., we tend to talk a lot about price to earnings, and here we're showing it at 22, so that is relatively high. In the middle chart, we have the forward PE, so trailing PE is taking current price against the past four quarters of earnings. That's what the 22 is. In the middle chart, looking at current price against the projected earnings for the next four quarters, we see that we don't look terribly expensive. We look on the expensive side of average since 1995, but we're not to one standard deviation rich. So this would indicate to something to us along the lines of, we do know the markets can get more expensive, and we've seen that in the past. Over the past 15 years, we're on the rich side of that. And so over the past 15 years, we're now coming up to a plus one standard deviation. And you can see we haven't really been there since before the global financial crisis, or coming right out of it, actually. So that's around January of 2010. So yes, we're getting a little bit pricey here on the earnings, price to earnings metric. And then international PE on the right-hand side there. But the volatility, which we see on page 34, is remarkably low. So even though we're getting expensive, the market doesn't seem to show much fear about this. And so the left-hand side implied volatility isn't quite as low as it's ever been, but it's pretty close here. This is through 331. And since then, it actually did touch 10. So we might have traced even lower since this came out. So the market's remarkably calm and not worried about all the things that we're typically concerned about. Doesn't seem like geopolitical risk is on the table. We have some terrorist activity, obviously, here and there. The White House is dominating headlines. That doesn't seem to be rocking the markets too much. And so what could it be? Well, let's turn to page 42. And just wrap up here with a look at the S&P 500 sectors. On the left-hand side, we have, for the quarter, information technology, and you can see all the sectors and how they did, energy and telecom at the bottom. What's not on this page is a little bit of the earnings reports, and so pretty much all of the S&P 500 companies have now reported earnings. And the numbers have been pretty terrific. So 75% of the companies beat on the earnings estimates against what analysts expected them to do. 64% of them beat on revenues, so that's higher than normal. The growth rate was 13.9%, just a whisker below 14% year-over-year growth in earnings. That's pretty remarkable. Going into the quarter, analysts expected 9%. So 9 versus 14, they really shot the lights out. Big difference was energy. Energy a year ago lost $1.5 billion. Energy this year gained $8.5 billion. So that was a big switch going from negative to positive. If you take out energy, though, you still have a 9.7%, almost a 10% growth in earnings year over year. So when we look at the markets and say, are the markets rich and should they be? Yes, they are by historical standards. Should they be? Maybe. These are pretty remarkable earnings. And so when we then look forward and say, okay, what do the analysts anticipate for Q2, Q3, and Q4 for this year? The numbers are looking pretty strong there now. So they're expecting 6.8% earnings growth in the second quarter, 7.5% earnings growth in the third quarter, 12.4% earnings growth in the fourth quarter. Those are all year-over-year numbers. Total earnings growth in 2017, 9.9%. So earnings in the U.S. doing pretty well. We'll see if that all comes to fruition, right? Because those are analysts, and the one thing we know about analysts is they're always wrong. But you got to start somewhere.
Yes.
Page 43 takes us through the benchmark returns. Upper left-hand side, domestic equities, nice numbers here, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6%, the highest Russell 1000 growth, so large cap growth companies did the best for the quarter to date. Down below that, international equities, we see emerging market doing quite well, 11.4% in the quarter, led by EM Asia at 13.4 down at the bottom, and Latin America at 12.1. So really good numbers there. Developed markets slightly better than what we saw here domestically. The upper right-hand side, fixed income for the quarter, kind of doing what we expect fixed income to do, slightly positive numbers, high yield being the standout, I guess, at 2.7%. And then down below in the other category, we have some commodities, REITs, leveraged loans, emerging market debt, hedge fund composites, and currency with various results. But you can see on this page with this kind of quarter, it was a pretty good quarter. We would take this all day long. Wherever you went, you pretty much made money except for commodities. And we don't have any commodities exposure, so pretty good quarter. So we can move into tab 2 and take a look at the performance of the plan, unless there are any questions. Keep rolling. Tab 2, page 2, take a look at the cash flow.
Yeah, take it easy out there.
Starting the quarter at $7.5 billion. Net cash outflows more than offset by investment change, and so ending market value of $7.7 billion. Taking a look at pages 3 and 4, everything here checks out in terms of market value and asset allocation history, long-term policy and compliance with policy, so everything looks good there. Turning to page 5, take a look at the performance. So total fund at 3.6% versus policy index at 3.9, so we had some underperformance by our managers. We'll talk about that momentarily, and that places us in 88th percentile. And you can see 1 year number of 9.9 against policy at 10.3, placing us in 92nd percentile. So interesting quarter and year, not the percentile rankings you're used to seeing, absolute returns. You know, who can complain about 9.9, so that's not so bad. We'll take a look at the drivers of this as well. So a portion of this is asset allocation, obviously, and then domestic equity tended to outperform international equity for the past year, and a bit of a reversal that we're seeing there in the current quarter. Page 6 continues through fixed income. We see outperformance here in fixed income and the liquidity program and risk diversifying fixed income, underperformance in high yield and inflation hedges. If we turn ahead to page 9, formative page of the performance report from a total plan basis over the past 5 years. Gross of fees, annualized return of 8.8% with a standardized deviation of below 5%. It's pretty remarkable. Sharpe ratio of 1.78, and you have your upmarket and downmarket capture ratios. So everything there looks really strong. And then page 10, manager by managers, taking a look through here. Intech, large cap core, slightly ahead of the index in 30th percentile. PIMCO stocks plus absolute return, also outperformed. Jackson Square underperformed for the quarter, and you can see that its longer history is now really brought down, which is kind of strange in the sense that if you look at the calendar years, 2012 to 2016, four of those calendar years it outperforms. It's 2016, it underperforms pretty significantly, and we haven't seen the recovery yet in 2017. So this quarter was due to its holdings in Qualcomm, L Brands. You probably know L Brands as the parent company to Victoria's Secret and other retailers. Retailers in general have had a difficult time. And TripAdvisor were also, those were three names that particularly hurt its performance. Outperformance by Robeco, Boston Partners, with some communication and consumer services and overweight investment technology helped it. Emerald underperformed for the quarter, underweight healthcare. Also some stock selection in producer durables and financial services, and Ceradex outperforming. If we turn to page 11, Pierford roughly in line with the index, 6.8 versus 6.7, gross of fees, so once you back out fees, slightly underperforms. William Blair also underperformed here, 7.4 versus 9.1. I'm starting to sound like a broken record. Some quarters are like this. Some quarters we see all the active managers, and it's an odd thing. You think we're getting diversification, then you have a quarter like this. But this happens, and past quarters we've seen them all outperform at the same time too. So we're just on the flip side of that coin right now. Emerging markets equity hasn't been funded yet as of 3/31, so that's why we're not showing it here. We're showing the asset allocation, but we don't have a quarter of return data. For the quarter, the PIMCO strategy returned 11.94% versus a benchmark at 11.44, so slight outperformance there, and we got a portion of that. Within global equities, Artisan Partners outperformed nicely, particularly relative to its peer group, 6th percentile. First Eagle underperformed, largely due to cash position. It has about 20% weight to cash, so conservatively positioned there and able to take advantage of market corrections when and if. Tech Global low fall, also underperformance there, with some stock selection in consumer discretionary and consumer staples. On the liquidity program, just getting this underway, so here we're seeing the DFA, short-term credit, outperforming due to some overweight in credit, underweight in government. And then Insight and SIT, both roughly in line with the index. Nothing particularly noteworthy.
SIT is in line with the index?
0.3.
But that puts it at the 94 percentile?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. So bond universes tend to be really tight. And so it tends, this is the kind of thing where if we carried it out another decimal point, it would probably be informative as to why that is. But, yeah.
Okay. I had a question back, Jackson Square. And this is the second or third time I've talked about Jackson Square. How long do we ride the horse? When do we do something about it? Or are we?
Yeah, I would generally couch this in terms of, we know we're going through a restructuring of the domestic equity program. Everybody is potentially in line for restructuring there. We've got a 6% target allocation to domestic equity, so this is in wind down mode here. Over the next 3 months or so, we're going to get through the last exercise we need before we can restructure that, and that's developing a game plan about where we're going to be housing dollars intended for the private markets in the public markets for a period of time before it's drawn down. I think once that game plan is in place, we're going to see the restructuring here. All managers will change their allocations in the process of that restructuring.
Three months? 6 months.
Between those two numbers, yes. We've got some contracting to do with StepStone before we get there.
Well, which brings me... So StepStone will be
assisting us
assisting
with that.
And in the long run doing it.
They will be assisting us in developing, StepStone and Verisk both will be assisting us with a game plan about how we're going to be investing dollars intended for the private markets in the public markets on the interim. So we'll have that exercise. That's the number one exercise they're going to do once we get a contract signed.
Okay.
Jerry, I could also point you to page 37. I think that's an interesting chart with this strategy. This is showing performance in a different way, rolling 3-year annualized returns and rolling 5-year against the benchmark. And you can see that they've gone through periods like this before. Yeah. They have underperformed, and then they go through a period of outperformance, then the period of underperformance. And as you might guess, the thing that we typically counsel is take a look at the engine that generates the returns. Is there anything that changed about that engine? If not, let it ride it out. And if we're going to make that switch, I'd rather make that switch when they're going through a period of outperformance. Most of the time, clients like the when they're outperforming, so it's hard to fire them. But that's kind of the when we want to rebalance those things. Let's see, just picking up on page 12, I think we were down through AFL-CIO. Allianz, high yield, underperformed with some selection within telecom and aerospace. Wellington, we see, well, this is underperformance relative to CPI plus 4. So CPI plus 4 is probably as much to blame here as what their performance was due to in terms of their commodities and currency positioning, but generating a positive return, which is what that strategy seeks to do. Did want to mention that Wellington received another notification from the SEC. SEC is coming in to look at their valuation of private markets instruments. We do not have exposure to that, so we don't believe it to have any impact on this strategy, but did want to make you aware that the SEC is coming in again, as we were made aware of that. I also, along those lines, along the regulatory lines, wanted to mention that First Eagle announced that they had they were under a subpoena. They had received a subpoena from the Department of Labor, and as of March 21st, they were notified that the Department of Labor concluded their investigation and no action is being taken. So wanted to share that bit of good news as well.
Has there been any I'm going to go to a different subject, but it was under scrutiny with
Veritas,
thank you. Where's the Securities Exchange Commission with that investigation, and what, you know?
I haven't received an update from them lately. I don't know. I can inquire. I can ask.
Would you please? Because that it involves a firm that we hired, and we said, no, we're not going to do it because they were under investigation, and now is that still going on or what?
I don't know. I'll find out. I'll ask.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Okay, turning ahead then to page 15, taking a look at the closed-end funds, funding schedule here. Tim, did you want to make any comments on?
Just on Angela Gordon Energy Credit Opportunities Fund, this was a fund that the board approved a few years ago intended to try to take advantage of some of the pricing discrepancies they were seeing in oil and gas related securities. You'll recall that we were pretty adamant that we didn't know how this narrative was going to play out in the marketplace, and so we worked with Angela Gordon to structure fees on invested capital only, so we weren't paying on committed capital here. As it turns out, the market didn't develop in the way they thought it might, so they only deployed 25% of the capital. They've released 65% of the capital back to all of the limited partners, and the remaining 10% expires on August 31st. So what they did deploy is performing as expected, but they didn't deploy as much as we expected. But we were protected on the management fee side.
And the next several pages then have the closed end funds, funding progress, and the IRRs for each of the strategies. And then pages 22 and 23 have the fees by investment strategy as well. So that concludes the review of the performance report, unless there are any questions, of course. Tab 3 has the risk dashboard. And I think we had talked last time about looking to find some meeting times where we have some flexibility in the schedule to do some education around the risk dashboards. I'd actually propose suspending this report until then, so that you're not having another report in front of you with information that's not clear if you should be taking action on any of it or how we would take action on any of it. Rather than put you in that position, just suspend this report, go through the education, talk about how we would want to do this and what it can be used for, how it would fit in with the FFP construct, and then come back, if and when appropriate, to bring this back. So I offer that for your consideration, if that's...
Makes sense to me. Particularly the integration piece to the FFP analysis, right? The bridging that as a go-forward tool for the...
Yeah. Yeah.
Portfolio.
Better in sync.
Okay.
Great. Thank you.
Silence is acquiescence. Yeah. Okay.
Full absorption.
I'll accept it as such. I don't know if that's always true, but I'll take that.
Thank you, Ed.
Can we use a larger font on page 2 next time?
Well, if we suspend it, then you won't see it. But yes, when we reintroduce it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think there are a few customization things I'd like to do with this report. Oh, yeah. The exposure by asset class. Chairman, that concludes my report.
Okay. I assume no other specific investments that you want to highlight for any particular reason, other than the ones you went down.
No, I think everything is moving along. Having the liquidity portfolio in place is nice now. Getting the emerging markets piece in place is nice. Not quite there, but getting it. And then. What we have parametric for the cash overlay now, so that's happening. And Stepstone now, getting them in place. So I think we have a lot of good things moving right now. You'll start seeing it in the reports soon. I think I'm content with where it is, where it's heading.
Okay. Any additional questions, discussion? Ed, thank you.
All right, thank you.